Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Gail Seiler, your host for today. It was a beautiful weekend here in Ames. I hope our listeners got out to enjoy it at least a little bit. It was also graduation time at ISU, so it was a busy and exciting and memorable time for many. I attended several of the graduation ceremonies, including the College of Ag and Life Sciences, and I also had the opportunity to attend a dinner honoring Hispanic graduates at ISU. That was very moving, as many of them had their families there, and many of them who were first-generation college graduates. We have a number of stories today about things going on in Ames and in Story County. In the second half of the show, we'll be joined by Keith Morgan from the Story County Emergency Management Agency. Keith will be talking about an exercise recently undertaken by the Emergency Operations Center. We'll also hear about a public discussion coming up around parking, car parking in Ames. But first, we're going to hear about an event that took place this past week on Wednesday evening. You may have seen flyers around town for it. It was a workshop designed to help people understand our implicit biases, where they come from, and how to change them. The focus was particularly on racial biases that we have. The presenter was Dr. Stephen Biggs, an assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies. We'll be hearing some audio from the actual workshop, but I was also interested in the behind-the-scenes efforts that brought this event to us. So I spoke with Jamette Colton, the person who spearheaded the idea to have this workshop. Can you tell us a little bit about how this event came to be, how it developed?
Last March of 2016, I went to the iScore conference at ISU, and I took several workshops, and then I took the Understanding Implicit Bias. And there were lots of things that he said that I realized that we can use in our daily life and to recognize those things. That was very important to me. So I decided, why not? Why can't we just have it for the whole community? It is so wonderful that we have the resources here in town that I can say, hey, Steve, do you want to do this? And he's agreed to it. I saw something that we could all benefit from.
And you're involved with Ames Progressive Alliance, and so you thought you'd see if they were interested in sponsoring it, and who else?
Correct. They were very enthusiastic. Then I went to the Ames Human Relations Commission's, and they are wonderful. Every time you go in, they're just so accepting, and they want the new ideas. So they were very open. They were in, and then I contacted Sean and Abdul from Black Lives Matter, and they were in. They liked the idea, so they wanted to do it. And then Mary contacted the Ames branch of the NAACP, and they were into, so the interest is theirs. And I think that's the beauty of it, is that we can bring all these groups together and partner and offer this for the community. This is just wonderful that we have this right now here in Ames, all the interests and these amazing groups. They've been doing a lot of stuff all along. I mean, the Ames branch of the NAACP, I mean, they've been around for a long time. So having them engage with us, I mean, it's an honor. So I love that the groups are wanting to collaborate.
So it started with something you saw, and it was held at the public library, and so they were on board as well. Why did you want to do this? Why did you think that, you know, you said that you benefited from it, but why did you think that the wider community could also benefit from it?
I think the interest is there. I work at the schools, and I see that there was a lot of people from the Ames School District, which it was wonderful to see. That I just feel that we should all be aware of what our brains are doing, and even though we may react like, oh no, that's not me. In fact, we all have that, and we can all do something. At least you recognize that you have it. I think that's a huge step, to recognize that maybe you're not as comfortable as you think you are. And to me, that is one of the first steps that you need to take.
Do you have any idea of how many people were there?
I want to say thousands. But I think there was, I think that room held, Mary said 205. And I'm guessing at least that, right? And you did mention the Ames Public Library, and I do want to give them a shout out because really, if you have a good idea, they're in. Mary and Lynn, they are amazing to work with. They take it, and it's almost like they take it, they run with it. They created the beautiful flyers. They're very welcoming.
Have you gotten any reactions from people? I know a lot of people stayed around afterwards and just continued talking. And so what kind of reaction have you heard?
People loved it. I think people were very impressed. I mean, it doesn't hurt that Steve was amazing. In fact, my husband, Chase, he was thinking that we, one, should do it again. And he was even throwing around that maybe we should do it longer. He ran out of time, that we could do like a maybe 3 hour and then have a break in the middle so people can visit. But people keep coming up to us. And they were so impressed and so happy that we did it.
My sense was that it could have been longer, and it would have been really interesting to have further discussions.
So Steve has been working with ISU police. I think the way he's doing it there, and I may be wrong, but I think he's doing it in like separate workshops, not just all at once. And that could be something that the school district could take advantage, the city law enforcement. So it's one of the things that people know that it's out there now, mm-hmm. and they could just reach out to him.
What do you hope happens next?
I'm hoping that people seek out more things like this. We have it right here in town. I want people to be resourceful and to us to take advantage of the expertise our community already has. And we can all benefit from it. Our children can benefit from it. In that way, we are acting like a true community. People just want to have more of this. And anybody can do it.
Well, thank you for coming up with the idea, bringing it to people's attention so you could get other people on board and make it happen. And thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you so much, Gail. I really appreciate it.
That was Jamette Colton, one of the people who organized the Implicit Racial Bias workshop that was held in Ames last week. The actual workshop lasted about 2 hours. It started with an explanation of how our brain works to make rapid decisions, which are based on implicit assumptions, and more deliberative decisions, which are more explicit and slower. The presenter, Dr. Stephen Bigg, showed how our racial biases emerge from the rapid system, which he called System 1. At one point, he had the audience call out responses to images that were flashing very quickly on the screen. Some were plants or animals or fish or not fish. So when you listen to that part, and it's in the section we're going to hear, pay attention to how fast the audience is responding. You can actually hear the difference between instances in which System 1 was operating alone and the response that you'll hear was very rapid. And then there are instances when System 2 was involved, and you can hear that the audience hesitated and the response was just a little bit slower.
So we're going to talk about implicit race bias. I'll start out by explaining what implicit bias is in general, nothing to do with race in particular, just what's an implicit bias. And after we talk about that, I'll use that understanding to say here's what an implicit race bias is. And then after we do that, we'll look at a few particular implicit race biases. We'll look at three. There's lots of different ones. I picked these three for reasons I'll explain when we get there. After we talk about these three implicit race biases, we'll talk about a couple of other things, and then we'll finish up. So that's more or less how things will go. So first, what's implicit bias? In order to understand what implicit bias is, you need to know a distinction between what's called System 1 and System 2. These are two systems for thinking, categorizing, and so on. And the easiest way to illustrate this is with a task, which is, it seems kind of silly participating in a context like this. It would be totally appropriate if you were four and this was Sesame Street, but here it's a little weird, but I want you to participate anyway because the point of these things is often lost on you if you don't. So you'll see objects appear on the screen. Each one will be a fruit or a vegetable, and you have to proclaim loud and proud fruit or vegetable for any object you see, and you have to do it quickly. So don't sit there and think about it, just react. Okay? So here we go.
Fruit. Vegetable. Vegetable. Fruit. Fruit.
Okay, good. Now, that was so fun, we're going to to do it again, but this time it's going to be fish or not fish. So here we go.
Fish, not fish, fish, not fish, not fish.
Okay, good. So what's the point? Well, when you have your tomato here, you take longer, in all likelihood. We didn't have reaction time, so I can't say this definitively of any given person or the group, but it's almost certain that you take longer to say fruit, even though you say fruit, most people say fruit, than you do for a paradigmatic fruit like a banana or an apple. Okay? And it was very pronounced in here with the manatee. Just about everybody said not fish, but there was a significant delay as compared to the monkey saying. And the question is, why is that? Why is it different? If you know a tomato is a fruit, why does it take you longer than it does for a banana? If you know a manatee isn't a fish, why does it take you longer than it does for a monkey? Okay? And the reason is because there's something inside you that wants to say that this thing is a fish, and there's something inside you that wants to say that tomato is a vegetable. It's an automatic categorization system. We can give it labels. The labels that I like come from a guy named Daniel Kahneman, System 1 and System 2. So System 1 is the automatic system. It's the one that categorizes the tomato as a vegetable and categorizes the manatee as a fish. Okay? System 2 is the more deliberate system. So System 1 is automatic, System 2 deliberate. It's the one that lets you say fruit when you see the tomato, even though System 1 is screaming at you to say vegetable. It's the one that lets you say not fish when you see the manatee, even though System 1 is screaming fish. The results of the processing for System 1 just pop into your mind. You just like, you know, vegetable, fruit, fish, not fish. It's not something you're sort of doing. It's something that's kind of happening to you. By contrast, System 2 results from willful effort. You do it. You make it happen. You think it through. You figure it out. Okay? Correspondingly, if you're asked to reconstruct some reasoning that you do or categorization that you do using System 2, you should be able to explain why you did it that way. If you're asked to reconstruct or explain why you did a categorization or why you thought what you thought, when the result comes from System 1, you may tell a story, but it often has just a story you're telling yourself. It doesn't have anything to do with the actual causal process that led to your judgment. System 1 computes on the basis of superficial similarity. Why does it say a tomato is a vegetable? Because the tomato's sweetness profile, which is sort of a crucial feature of a food, it matches up more with a carrot or an onion, and it doesn't match up very well with an apple or a banana. Okay? By contrast, System 2 can apply rules or guidelines. It can appeal to memorized facts. It can say, hey, here's what makes it the case that this thing is a fruit, or it can say, look, I've memorized this fact, tomatoes are fruits. System 1 computes probabilities on the basis of the stimuli that you as an organism have been hit with throughout your life. By contrast, System 2 can compute probabilities on the basis of impersonal beliefs about frequencies. So here's kind of a silly example to illustrate this distinction, which again will be an important distinction going forward. So imagine a kid who's raised on a farm where they raise hairless dogs. So in this kid's personal stimulus history, supposing this kid has never seen movies or TV, dogs and hairlessness go hand in hand. Okay. Now, the kid reads an encyclopedia article, and in the article it says like 99.8% of dogs are hairy. Well, the kid, if you ask him and say, are dogs hairy, he's going to say, yeah, most dogs are hairy. But if you show him pictures of hairy dogs, it's going to take him longer to categorize it as a dog than if you show him pictures of a hairless dog. Immediately, that's a dog. Hairy dog, there's something funny. It doesn't quite fit, so it takes longer. Okay? And that's because System 1 just cares about the stimuli that you've been hit with, the regularities that have been present in your environment, not the regularities as they are out there in the world, not what you know about. Okay? This over here is the realm of the implicit. That over there is the realm of the explicit. So when we talk about implicit race bias, we're talking about a bias that's in System 1. It's present in System 1, either because it's built in or because of implicit race bias, because it's conditioned. So a couple things to notice. First, System 1 can impact your behavior even if System 2 wins out at the end of the day. And that's what happens in the case where, you know, you see the banana and you immediately say fruit, you see the tomato and you still say fruit, but there's a delay. So in this case, System 1 has changed the way you behave even though System 2 won out. If you looked at the behavior 5 minutes after the fact in each case, you'd say each person, you know, he said fruit for banana, he said fruit for tomato, but it would look the same. But if you're measuring things in real time, you can see System 1 is getting in there and saying, say vegetable, and it impacts your behavior. It's also the case that System 1 can impact your behavior even if you're slowing down and you're using System 2. You're doing slow deliberation. System 1 can impact your behavior without you even realizing it. And we'll demonstrate that that's the case later on, because we won't be talking about deliberation for a little while yet. But here's an example. So why did you call the eggplant, not everybody did, but most people call the eggplant a vegetable. Why? Right? Did you have to think about it? Did you apply some theory that you know? No, right? It's a vegetable. You see it, you categorize it as a vegetable. As a matter of fact, it's a fruit for the very same reason that a tomato is a fruit, but that's not the point. The point isn't about getting it right or getting it wrong. The point is, this automatic categorization system says this thing, in terms of sweetness and so on, is more similar to a standard vegetable than it is to a fruit. So say vegetable. And that's what dominates the judgment in somebody who hasn't memorized the relevant fact or doesn't know the relevant theory. Okay. So now we can use this to see what an implicit race bias is. An implicit race bias is basically a case where your system one reacts differently based on the perceived race of the person. Now, race is in scare quotes here. Sometimes when you start talking about races, people assume you're meeting sort of significant genetic categories where the genes are determining some, you know, significant psychological profile or something like that. That's not what we're talking about here. All the, you know, races are often thought of in biology among geneticists and certainly among philosophers as social categories, not biological categories, not genetic categories. But for our purposes, none of that matters. All that matters is this. He's a member of a given race group by, for the purposes of what we're doing, if people see him as a member of that group. All that matters is how people see you for our purposes. Okay? Because what we're talking about is how system one reacts to people. And that's sort of stress, that's what matters. The word relevantly there is there for a reason. Not every difference that comes out of system one counts as implicit race bias. And the reason is this. The bias has to be the kind of thing that will lead to discriminatory behavior if left unfettered, sort of all by itself. And not every difference you get out of system one will do that. So here's two phases. Perceptual processes are part of system one. You're seeing this as darker than this, right? You're seeing the nose here as narrower than the nose here. Well, none of that taken by itself will automatically lead to discriminatory behavior. That is, if you don't have further implicit biases built into the system, you're not going to get discriminatory behavior just out of seeing different colors, any more than you would treat a, you know, black square and a white square differently, right? You need further biases built into the system to get a discriminatory behavior out of a perceptual difference like this. So a bias built into system one is relevant, or a differential reaction by system one is relevant only if it will, taken alone, lead to discriminatory behavior. So now we'll talk about a couple of particular implicit race biases. The first one we'll talk about is weapons bias, the second one is threat bias, and the third one is anger bias. There's others beyond those. These are just the ones I picked. And I picked them for the following reasons. First and foremost, it's really easy to expect that we have these biases if you know a little bit of background in cognitive and perceptual psychology, and you make some plausible suppositions about our environment. That is, if you know a little bit of background about how we work, and you make some plausible suppositions about what our environment is like, you would just expect us to have exactly these biases. So you sort of wouldn't even need data to say we probably have these, okay? We'll still look at data that you do, but part of the reason I chose them is they sort of follow naturally from facts about how we work and facts about our environment. The other reason is, with very few exceptions, and I'll highlight the exceptions that are relevant, these are all experiments that have been replicated over and over and over with consistent findings where most subjects perform the same way. So these aren't one-off experiments where, you know, maybe if you did it again, you'd get a totally different result. These are highly reliable experiments. Okay. So let's start with this fact about how we work, that we compute probabilities on the basis of personal stimulus history using system one. And now let's make a supposition about my personal stimulus history. So this is a supposition about me. And the supposition is this. In my personal stimulus history, including media, and it's crucial I'm including media here, so I'm including the TV shows I've seen, the movies I've seen, and so on and so forth, the news programs I've seen. The percent of black people who have had a gun is greater than the percent of white people who have had a gun. Okay? Now, crucially, this isn't a supposition about the actual environment. My claim here isn't that in the real world, the percent of black people who have guns is greater than the percent of white people who have guns. That's irrelevant, because remember, those kinds of facts about frequencies that you can learn in textbooks are irrelevant to my system one. My system one knows what it's seen, the condition it's received. So, you know, there's a Pew study which finds that about twice as many white households have guns as black households. And I can read that study till the cows come home, and that's not going to recondition the relationship in my system one, because my system one doesn't care about that. It cares about the visual presentation of the gun with the visual presentation of the face. So these kind of frequency facts are just irrelevant. They go away. We're talking about my personal stimulus system. So if you use that as your only evidence, and remember, system one is only sensitive to that kind of thing, here's what you conclude. You conclude that the probability that an object is a gun, given that it's paired with a black person, or a black face is greater than the probability that an object is a gun given that it's paired with a white person. Now again, the point isn't that this is a rational conclusion because it's based on the skewed sample, that's my personal stimulus history. The point is this is how this organism right in front of you has been conditioned. Now, here's a question for you. Given what we know about how I work, that I have this automatic system, its judgments just pop into mind, it computes probabilities on the basis of my personal stimulus history, and let's say it can drive my behavior in certain cases, and this fact about my personal stimulus history, what would you predict about my behavior? And I want you to actually talk to each other about this for just a minute or two, and then we'll come back to the main group, and so just go ahead and talk about it for a minute.
We've been listening to the opening portion of a workshop on implicit race bias that was recently held at the Ames Library. The speaker, Dr. Stephen Biggs, went on to talk about three particular race biases, what he called weapons bias, threat bias, and anger bias. It was easy to see how these biases might influence, for example, the actions of police or of people if they are in positions that they perceive as dangerous or threatening. But it also struck me that racial bias, this kind of implicit racial bias, can be manifested in all kinds of day-to-day interactions as well. For example, as we go about our daily routines or as we interact in institutions such as schools or businesses. For example, researchers recognize that this kind of implicit racial bias likely plays a role in the racial disparities that are so prominent in school discipline data. Near the end of his talk, Dr. Biggs spoke about reducing or mitigating our racial biases, but he said there is not yet a strong enough understanding of how to do this. However, there is a great deal of work being done in this area. One study that I've read a while back found that working on a collaborative project with people of races that you hold bias against seemed to reduce people's implicit bias. Dr. Biggs also pointed out that even if we were able to eliminate all of this racial implicit bias, it still would not eliminate structural or institutional racism. That will take other kinds of changes at the structural and institutional levels. Thanks to Jamette Colton for providing information on this event, and to Dr. Steve Biggs from ISU, and to the library for allowing us to record it and share it with our listeners who were not able to be there. Switching gears now, Nitin Gadia, a resident of Ames, has been educating himself about parking. Most of us do it, park that is, but few of us have considered that this can involve far-reaching public issues and consequences. Nitin appeared recently before the city council to raise concerns about parking in Ames, and he plans to be part of a public discussion that the city council will hold on Tuesday, May 16th at 6 p.m. in the city council chambers in Ames. In preparation, he's taken things a step further. To help us understand parking better, Nitin will co-host the showing of a video presentation. The video is called The High Cost of Free Parking. Together with Susan Bradbury, professor of community and regional planning at ISU, the video features a talk by a highly respected national expert on parking. Nitin stopped by KHOI and recorded a brief interview with Ursula Rudenberg to get the word out about what is happening this week with that event and to give you a sense of what kinds of issues related to parking will be raised. Here's Nitin.
We're going to show a short filmed presentation, less than an hour, and after the film, we're going to have a discussion. I'm a resident of Ames. I live on Main Street. Out of concern for the community I live in, I wanted to put this on with Susan Bradbury, professor at Community and Regional Planning Department at Iowa State. Also, the Ames Bicycle Coalition, their co-sponsor. It's a really entertaining talk, actually. It's called The High Cost of Free Parking, the same title as the influential book by the same author. Donald Shoup, considered the foremost expert on parking.
Can you give an idea of what he will be talking about?
Donald Shoup's central point of view is parking is a chronic problem caused by government policies.
So why are you showing this movie now?
Because there's a parking workshop being held by the city the following Tuesday, May 16th. The city council is having it, so it's going to be kind of a discussion with the city council and the community.
It's a public event?
Yeah. It's something that we can all participate in, and we should.
And when is that?
It's on May 16th at 6 p.m. at the city council chambers.
Does this video prepare people for that event?
The video gives an overview of the problem. breaks it all down and explains what the solutions are to the problem of parking. So when people come to the meeting, they'll have an informed opinion. It's pretty common for people to spend dozens of hours of their lives looking for parking, worrying about parking, complaining about parking. This is just a short event that will thoroughly inform you and will kind of open up your eyes to the bigger picture. You'll come away empowered with an understanding of how to solve the issue.
Can you explain some of the issues?
There's a lot that doesn't meet the eye about parking. It seems like the problem of parking is that there's not enough parking. The problem with parking is not the amount of parking that's available. Making parking available to people is not an issue of having more parking spots. It sounds totally counterintuitive, but the reason why parking meters exist is because otherwise people are just going to stay in those parking spots. People actually, like way back, like in the 30s, asked for parking meters everywhere. Because parking became such a chronic problem, they introduced parking meters to try to get people to move from those parking spots.
The problem was people would stay in the spots forever.
Right. The number of people in Campus Town that hoard parking spots because, you know, they work. The price of parking should be cheaper, for example, in the parking garage. So people park off the street. For example, I know somebody personally who is a waitress at a restaurant there, and she parks right in front of the business, and that's just the best option for her.
So yeah. The idea is on the street, you want to have a flow of movement.
Right. In one city, they implemented Donald Shoup's ideas, and they created total availability of parking. It's interesting. In San Francisco, they implemented something where overall the availability of parking freed up. And average cost actually went down in the whole city. Basically, as people would park on a block, there would be parking sensors and the parking cost would go up gradually as more and more people parked on the block. And eventually people figured out that I just need to park where it's most optimal and where I can get the cheapest parking. And the cost of parking goes down when people would just park a block away. That's public parking. Probably an even bigger issue is private parking that's required by law. Minimum parking requirements is a big, big one. Like most cities in the country, the city of Ames requires by law that any property has to have minimum parking requirements.
Can you explain what you mean? It's hard to picture what you're saying.
Yeah. Many people don't know this. Properties require parking on site.
Business is required to have parking spaces?
Either on site, meaning on the property itself, or within 300 feet. That's the rule in the city of Ames, in Campus Town and downtown anyway. I think that in many places, the only way you can do it is to provide it on the property itself. So, for example, if you go to Target, all of that parking around Target is required by law. And that just logically requires it to be like a strip mall environment. I'll also say is that the issue of minimum parking requirements goes way beyond just parking. I didn't really realize it until I looked into it that basically sprawl is required by law. It's not like a free market phenomenon at all. It's required by law through things like zoning and minimum parking requirements. It is a social justice issue because basically it's requiring by law for our communities to be unwalkable, to be a parking lot essentially, and requires the cost of everything to go up. I go to Wheatsfield and they were required, their minimum parking requirements essentially required them to buy two houses and demolish them just for a few more spots. It cost them $500,000. All of that money is going into the cost of my food.
Because of a requirement.
Yeah, everybody struggles. I mean, even the property owner who's trying to build a nice porch is struggling in that respect.
And this all stems from the required parking law?
Yeah, minimum parking requirements. Yeah. Believe it or not, because of minimum parking requirements, we spend more now on parking than we do on Medicare. And nobody is really aware of it.
So what's the alternative to minimum parking requirements? If you have cars coming into a town, you need to put them somewhere.
Minimum parking requirements created that problem. Basically, when you have minimum parking, it actually creates more demand for driving and for parking. It has the characteristics of an addiction because people are required to drive. I mean, unless you're lucky to live in a walkable community, you are basically required to drive.
The alternative would be being able to walk to locations and public transportation?
Yeah. I live on Main Street. I walk to get my groceries and for most of my needs. And I get around with Uber. I get around by bicycle. And it's very efficient, actually. You know, I'm one of the few people who's lucky to live on Main Street. I found an apartment that I was able to live in. But most of those apartments are not – any small property owner cannot rent out their upstairs apartment. Minimum parking requirements are the biggest problem. There are requirements for residences. I'm on the Main Street District Economic Vitality Committee, and the findings were that, yeah, there's literally no space to meet the minimum parking requirements, especially if you wanted to update the properties, if you wanted to have more development. People are not allowed by law to live in downtown. What triggered me to do this is there is a developer that's about to demolish a bunch of buildings in Campus Town and build a new building, and his plans included a porch in the back. He's required by law to have parking spots in the back.
You're saying he has to build parking spaces instead of a porch?
Essentially, yes. Randall Corporation is going to be demolishing a few buildings and building two stories of residences on top of the existing properties. And he wanted to build a big porch in the back across the whole property. It would be this nice social gathering space in the center of Campus Town. But now he's required to provide 8 parking spots.
Why 8?
Because there are 8 units in that apartment complex. Essentially, the city's requiring him by law to have parking instead of a porch. And a porch would be beneficial to the Campus Town. There are just a couple porches in Campus Town, and they are always full of people, thriving social environment, you know. And you're replacing that with 8 parking spots? Where are our priorities? In downtown and Campus Town, because it's so dense, they require 1 parking spot per unit. But in most places in Ames, it's 1 parking spot per bed on site. It's one of the number one problems in this country for housing to be vacant, to deteriorate, that there to be a shortage of housing supply. Minimum parking requirements are the problem. That's just what I've gathered from my reading. But if you want to come and inform yourself from what Donald Shoup says, you should come to this meeting and have a discussion. The event's called The High Cost of Free Parking. It's on Thursday, May 11th at 6 p.m. at the City Hall Council Chambers.
That was Nitin Gadhia speaking with Ursula Rudenberg. Again, High Cost of Free Parking will be shown Thursday, May 11th at 6 p.m. at the City Hall Council Chambers, and the City Council will also host a public discussion about Ames parking laws on Tuesday, May 16th at 6 p.m. in City Council Chambers. We're going to take a short music break before we move on to our next guest, so we're going to hear a song by Nina Simone.
I ain't got no home, ain't got no shoes, ain't got no money, ain't got no class, ain't got no skirts, ain't got no sweater, ain't got no perfume, ain't got no bed, ain't got no mind, ain't got no mother, ain't got no culture, ain't got no friends, ain't got no schooling, ain't got no love, ain't got no name, ain't got no ticket, ain't got no token, ain't got no God. And what about God? Why am I alive anyway? Yeah, what about God? Nobody can take away. Got my hair, got my head, got my brains, got my ears, got my eyes, got my nose, got my mouth, I got my smile, I got my tongue, got my chin, got my neck, got my boots, got my heart, got my soul, got my back, I got my sex, I got my arms, got my hands, got my fingers, got my legs, got my feet, got my
Well, that'll wake you up. That was Nina Simone. The song was called Ain't Got No, I Got Life. Nina Simone was a singer and a pianist, but people may not know that she was also a civil rights activist, and that activism actually hurt her career. There's a fascinating documentary about her that's available on Netflix. It's called What Happened, Miss Simone, if you want to learn more about her life. But we've been joined in the studio now by Keith Morgan from the Story County Emergency Management Agency. Keith is here for his monthly local talk visit. Thanks for being with us, Keith.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Today we're going to be talking about the full-scale exercise that you all recently did to activate the Emergency Operations Center. So let's get right into it. When did that exercise take place and what was it?
Well, it took place on April 26th, and by a full scale, it's some of the terminology we use, but it was actually moving people and things to get them in position to act as if a real event had happened to see how well we could do if such an event were to occur.
And so you had an actual scenario, I gather.
Yes, our scenario was just in a very generic term that Huxley had been hit by a tornado. And these folks knew that we were going to do an exercise on the 26th because I had to coordinate to make sure that there'd be enough staffing to be able to do both the stuff that they do at Story County Administration and come in and do our exercise. But that's all they knew. And it started right off with us walking through the process to activate our EOC. What's interesting about our Emergency Operations Center is it's designed to support a community and first responders should there be a large-scale event. And Story County Administration has allowed us to use their staff to fill and staff our EOC. So that's an important part. So we began, first off, by calling the chair of the Board of Supervisors, Rick Sanders, and saying, hey, simulated, we've had this event happen. Can we activate our EOC, and is it okay for us to use your staff? And, of course, he said yes. And then we have a mass notification system, and we just sent out via text, voicemail, and email, come down to our EOC. And that's all the people knew when they were arriving.
So all the employees, all the staff that might be involved in a real emergency were notified that way.
Exactly. We've selected about 40 from the staff and some from Iowa State University Vet Med and some from our volunteer fire departments are all on the staff. So they show up and they have no idea what's going on, and we have them sign in. And we give them just the basic, a tornado has happened in Huxley. Radio traffic indicates that. And that's what gives it the realism, because mm-hmm. if I was to roll out a map and say, well, the tornado went through here, these facilities were affected, it would help them, but it'd be unrealistic, because one of the things that in crisis response is you're always acting under incomplete and sometimes inaccurate information. So that was a major part of this exercise, was to get the staff to start to feel that kind of pressure and that uncertainty. So they all came in, and slowly we started to feed them some information, and they had to get going right away, and we ran into some of the problems you would. Oh, what's my password to sign into the computer? Because this isn't their normal job. So we got them going, and we slowly fed them some information. After that, they learned that, well, there was a simulated truck that was knocked over on I-35, and they think there's hazardous material in it. And then a little bit later, we tell them this same tornado hit a hog-producing facility. So now they had to deal with that. So now we're also going across. It's in Huxley. It's also outside of Huxley in many different places. So it was interesting for them.
And so you had to have all the imaginary details figured out in advance. So you had to obviously do a lot of planning.
This is where I was very lucky, and it was a secondary benefit to this. I employed some of my counterparts from around. I had the emergency manager from Marshall County, the deputy coordinator for Polk County, Jasper County, and Boone County all came on over, and they role-played. In fact, one of the guys had the sound of sirens recorded on his cell phone, so when he was calling in, you could hear tornado sirens going off in the background. And the participants in the exercise commented that really brought realism to it. So it took us about 6 months to get all of these different kinds of inputs put together for the exercise.
Wow, because little details like that I would think would really raise the adrenaline level or stress level or something of the people who are participating if it was felt that real.
Exactly. In fact, we actually had KCCI, we contacted them and they recorded a simulated news broadcast. And there was two parts to this, again, to add to the realism and also so that the staff inside the EOC, whether they would pay attention to it and extract the information from what's coming out over media, because we can't just rely on information coming from those that are involved in the response. They're very busy. We have to draw in all sorts of information from as many places as we can.
So you actually kind of had fake news coming, so to speak.
Exactly.
Into the group that they had to react to.
Exactly. And another major part to this was our public information officer. We had inputs for them that were simulating information coming across social media. For instance, help, I'm trapped in my a text comes across or a tweet comes across, help, I'm trapped in my house. What would a person that's doing public information do with that bit of information? So it a lot of different places, a lot of different parts put together, but the exercise itself went very well.
So this Emergency Operations Center is actually a physical place. It's not just a group of people. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. When I started the job, we had what we called our EOC was just a bunch of tables and chairs. And what we did is over time, we share a lot of our resources in order to make it very cost effective. Story County Information Technology has computers that they train on. Well, they have set those computers up in my Emergency Operations Center. They get to do training without having to set up the computers and take them down. And if I need to, the Emergency Operations Center, they're there ready to go right away. We put in phones and we've put up monitors so we can display information. All of that together has made it so we've gone to what we call a warm EOC, Emergency Operations Center. It can be activated.
Warm?
Warm.
What does that mean?
Cold would be what we had before, just
okay.
An empty room.
Okay.
Warm means that we got it up and running in about 30 minutes or so.
Uh-huh.
A hot EOC would mean there's people sitting in it all the time.
All the time.
Exactly.
Okay. Where is this actual place?
It's down,
or are you not allowed to say?
It's down in the basement of the Story County Administration Building. If anybody would want to come on by and see it, I'd encourage them. We're on the Story County website. They can look up our phone number. It's 515-382-7315, and we can give you a tour. The only thing is that oftentimes we're out of the office, so if you just stop by, we may or may not be there, but if you call beforehand, we can make arrangements for folks to come out and see it.
Let's get back to the actual simulation then. You had two groups of people, I understand, kind of in shifts, imagining that this went over a long period of time. Is that right?
Yeah. When you're working with staff, everybody runs through one cycle. But the real difficulty, especially in these kinds of situations, is to simulate that this would be going on for 12-hour shifts. How do you pass information
that
from
transition.
Shift one to shift two?
Mm-hmm.
So we practiced that also to make sure that information would flow both within the shift and between shifts. And that's one of the areas where we found that the processes that we had instituted, my deputy and I, we need to go back and try something else because we were just plain overwhelmed, both trying to provide direction to those inside the Emergency Operations Center and keep track of all these tasks that were going on.
So that was one of the things you learned, an area for improvement.
Definitely. That was probably the major one, but that's why we do these exercises.
And you also actually had simulated press conferences, is that right?
We did, and that's where our public information officers were really put to the test. And also some of our jurisdictional executives. We had people from Huxley that actually came up and coordinating both between the county entities and Huxley's entities. And some new folks got thrown in front of a simulated press conference, really put them on the spot. But they feel like they learned an awful lot from that. And our processes for our public information officer also to be able to gather information and put it out there in a timely manner was tested.
Did you debrief with the participants afterwards to get feedback from them about what supports could have helped them more or what they learned from it?
We sent them out an email that had a whole series of questions on it to try and gather that information because that's key. we often call them lessons learned, and they're not lessons learned until you do something. They're lessons mm-hmm. identified. So we've gathered up the lessons. Now we need to go back through and figure out how we're going to make those modifications that we need to.
What are the other lessons identified?
A lot of, again, those internal processes, because what we're trying to do is track tasks as they come into us, because, again, we're going out and finding resources. We had one process that we thought would work. It didn't. Well, it did work. We were tracking them again, but it was just the overwhelming. And there's multiple systems we can do that with. And how we blend those together was another key part to it. It did prove some of the stuff works well. Our initial notification, like I said, worked well. So it's your opportunity to make sure that works well. Keep what's working mm-hmm. as part of your processes, and then go and find different ways to modify that, which is not. Training was another big one. Just like I said, what's my password? Everybody says we need to do training more often. And that's good to know that the staff at Story County is really motivated to do well on this. And they did very well because many of them are not used to trying to operate under these kind of conditions.
What would you say was the purpose of this exercise?
Again, it was to test our procedures, to expose those that have never had the opportunity to be in that environment, expose them. One of the great comments I heard was that one of our participants said, I was just at that point of phone rage that I was going to throw the phone across the building because she wasn't getting an answer to information, which is very realistic. And it put them to that point, and that was one of the most important parts of the exercise. So now we have a group of people, but they'll change. So somewhere down the road, we'll go ahead and run another one of these, maybe make it more difficult or try and actually link into one of our communities while we're doing it.
Is working with the staff to help them develop strategies for dealing with that stress, is that something that would be commonly be done?
What we do is we started way back with the basics of communications in this type of an environment. Our first training was, what do you do if somebody calls in and says they want 6-inch pumps? You don't allow them to just say, yes, I want 6-inch pumps. You ask them a series of questions. So you only have to talk to them one or two times instead of five times. So you want 6-inch pumps for what? Who are you? Are you authorized to order that up? Who's going to pay for it? Where does it need to be delivered to? Gathering that kind of information. So those are some of the strategies. Prioritization. What's the most important thing I have to do now? What do I have to do in 5 minutes from now, an hour from now, and then 3 hours from now? Once you get that sort of way of dealing with a crisis, it never gets so that it's really easy, but it gets so it's mm-hmm. manageable.
Mm-hmm. It almost seems like they would need like breathing exercises or something to manage the stress during the actual event.
It's so fast-paced that most of them wouldn't even think to do
no
it
time for that
during the exercise. I was very impressed, though. Everybody was motivated to do the absolute best that they could, and they adapted quite well to the new environment.
I imagine a lot of the decisions have to be made kind of on the spot, spontaneously. But is there also a flow chart of things that can guide people that's been planned in advance?
We haven't got a flow chart, but you're right. There's what we've told them, and our job is to try and find options for the communities themselves. Communities also need to have this kind of structure within them to be able to rapidly get situational awareness. So what we do is we put together options, and then who gets to decide which option is kind of that flow chart. If it's a resource that my agency is going to be getting, well, then I'm the primary person to make that decision. If it's a community, hey, we can get that to you very fast but very expensive, or slower and cheaper. What do you want to have happen? So that's where our linkage has got to be down to the community itself, so that they understand what their responsibilities are and manage that risk that they'll be dealing with during a response.
A big part of your emergency response to something like this, I would imagine, is also communication out to the public. Obviously, you couldn't test that with a scenario like this. But are there other ways that you assess how well your communication is set up to get information out to the general public?
That is actually one of the key bits to our public information officer, and we were testing that. Were they thinking about what do we need to get to the public to tell the public, please go here, please do not come to this area here, because that is one of the greatest tools. Iowans are great about responding, and sometimes that we need that kind of a response, but we need it as a measured rate. And part of what we tested with our public information officer was, what kind of messages do you want to get out to the public? Social media is going to be in the future one of the most difficult things, because it can be both a tool, like I said, you can extract information from social media, and also you can answer some of the questions within social media to drive them away from the rumors and the things that are wrong and to what information is right. And that's one of the areas we're going to have to work on, because just the resources it takes to monitor all the different social media avenues that are out there to extract the information you need and also to interface with it is very difficult. Our office doesn't really use Twitter, just because we don't want the public to think we're going to be able to get information out rapidly for that. And there's only two of us on a normal response, so we just wouldn't have time to monitor and interface with it. So that is, across all of emergency management, one of the most important things that we've got to work on.
So in the simulation, you couldn't actually get the information out, but you had people preparing for that and thinking about what they would have gotten out to the public and how, if the situation had been real.
We could have designed. They do have social media simulations, but we didn't have the funding for it.
Mm-hmm.
And we got quite a bit of information out of what we did. When we do exercises, we try and design them to test up to the level and a little bit beyond on where we think we're at. We don't design them for us to fail, essentially, mm-hmm. on them, especially if we have a known gap on it. But again, down the road, and that's working with my commission, which is made up of all of the jurisdictional executives across the county, if we get to that point and if we want to invest in that kind of support for an exercise, we could easily do something like that.
So overall, you would say it was a success?
The design of the exercise was definitely a success. We did hit some areas where we were testing. So, yeah, it showed us what we need to work on, and it verified some of our procedures.
What the public can learn from that is that they're in good hands, and that they should feel confident in that. And then I guess the other thing to communicate to the public is that when an emergency happens, they should listen to the advice that they're getting from your agency and people involved in it.
Exactly. We're trying to take care of the public, and the public can do this too. You know, your family fire drills within your house, especially if you have younger kids. It's the same sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's an exercise to make sure your procedures work and you can communicate. So I encourage them to do that, or a tornado drill within the house. Same concept.
That's a good bit of advice. So we'll end there. Thank you very much, Keith. We've been speaking with Keith Morgan, the Story County Emergency Management Coordinator.
Thanks.
We also wanted to let people know that the Ames Community School District School Board tonight at their meeting will be having a discussion and likely a vote on a resolution concerning the school district policy on making sure our schools are safe and secure places for immigrant students. There will be an opportunity to hear the discussion as well as make comments if people want to. That's tonight at the Ames Community School Board meeting at 6 p.m. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also listen to today's Local Talk show and all of our past shows on our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. KHOI is a community radio station that is driven by volunteers and made possible by donations from individuals, businesses, and organizations in the community. So please support KHOI. It's always easy to donate or become a member. Just go to our website and look for the donate button at khoifm.org. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show, which means that you can be part of our team of volunteer producers and reporters. If you would like to join the team, contact us at 515-292-2878 or via our website. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.